As a young person in the 50s and 60s, I have, well, we have all been witness to and affected by the world around us. In the book Fighter Pilot's Daughter, A Story of the 60s and the Cold War, author and professor Mary Lawler details unconventional upbringing in Cold War America. Memories of her early life as the daughter of a Marine Corps and later an Army officer's father, Mary reveals the personal costs of tension that gripped her and her family, and indeed, the entire world. She brilliantly outlines the unique challenges and upbringing with military roots affected her and her sister and her mother. In 19th century American literature, American naturalism and romanticism, Native American literature, the literature of film of the Cold War and militarization in the American narrative are just a few of the concentrated subjects our author and teacher shares with us. As professor of English and director of American Studies at Muhlenberg College, she has also penned two other notable books, Recalling the Wild, Naturalism and the Closing of the American West, and Public Native America, Tribal Self-Representation in Casinos, Museums, and Powwows. You are sharing these 30 minutes of Lehigh Valley Art Salon with us, and we are ever so glad you are here. This is WDIY FM 88.1 on your digital device. I remain George Miller, and along with my wife and co-host Kate Scuffle, today we chat with teacher, author Mary Lawler. Welcome.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
Hi, Mary. We were saying earlier, it's funny, sometimes the best conversation happens out in the green room as we're waiting to come on, so we'll try and recapture that for the audience. But I was really struck, just really unexpectedly moved by your book. When I saw the title, Fighter Pilot's Daughter, I thought, this is a memoir or a story that will be interesting to me but not necessarily speak to me or resonate with me. What do I have in common with that? And was really powerfully struck by how intimate and detailed a memoir, a family story it is, and yet how it also resonates as a story of a generation and a time and place, and how the two things kind of reverberate and affect each other and inform each other.
Well, I'm very happy to hear that because it's very much what I hoped to achieve in writing it. The Cold War was such a dramatic time to be growing up, and in a military family, all of the foreign policies that Washington established ended up having a direct effect on my father's work, because he was a pilot for the Marine Corps and then later for the Army. And so, you know, when the president made certain decisions, they had almost an immediate effect on what my father did or didn't do. And then those orders that he had for his work sifted down into our household. We would have to pack up and move again when, you know, some event happened at some part in the world that he would have to go off and attend to. We might not go to that part of the world with him, but we'd go someplace else in the United States to live while he was away. And that happened so often. And we moved again and again and again.
What was it, like 30 homes, 30 houses?
Yeah, well, we moved at least. I went to 14 different schools by the time I graduated from high school. And several of those moves involved sub-moves within the same place. So, for example, when we lived in Alabama, I think we had five or six different houses. And when we were in Miami, we had many different houses. Some of them we were only in for a couple of months. So there were lots and lots of moves. And that's pretty typical for military kids of that time. Many people I know moved a lot more than that. I spoke to a woman a couple of weeks ago whose family moved 26 times by the time she was 13. You know, so it's very common. And it's really a way that affects you personally, but it also, if you can tell the story of that, it also gives you a broader vision of, you know, of world history that can help make a story like I was hoping to make, that moved from the personal to the more political and the more general in the way that you described.
Well, it's interesting, too, because for Fighter Pilot's Daughter, but the house, and you have sisters, several sisters, your Franny, your mom is there, dad's gone for months at a time, depending on the mission or what's going on. Franny's making a new home again and again and again and again, but it's a woman's home, And I love the description. You said when you were very young, when your father would come home, not because there was anything wrong with him or you were afraid of him, but he just took all the air out of the room because it was like this hero, this kind of larger-than-life figure. But in coming out of World War II, that would have been how these men also saw themselves. They were protecting, you said, of our liberty, of our place in the world, of keeping the dark forces from invading. And
yes.
You know, what stood between us and chaos.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It was very dramatic for them. And when my father came home, it was just terrifying in a way to see him. I mean, he was a big man. He was 6 feet tall, and he had a big frame. And he could fill a door frame up. Mm-hmm. But it was his presence that was so big, even more so than his physical body, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. And he had these ice blue eyes that would develop a kind of aviator's gaze when he'd been away at war, or war vision. It looked like he was looking at something far away, even as he was looking at you. Hmm. It was a strange gaze. Hmm. And of course, he had been in an all-male environment that was, you know, in a daily way violent. It was supposed to be violent. It was supposed to be dangerous all the time. And so he was ready. He was fired up. He had this adrenaline running in him that hadn't been stepped down to domestic life yet, you know, when he'd come home.
Yes.
So it was really startling when we'd see him, you know, get off the plane on the tarmac when he'd come back. And then being in the house, it was almost as if the house was too small for him.
I love the sense, too, though, of your mom being this kind of big energy or a character at times, but also beautiful childhood memory of them going out to a party, and she's in the black cocktail dress and the pearls and the gold bracelets and the dark hair, and just these kind of the sense of place and caste within the military system, that you were an officer's daughter and this was an officer's wife. And yet also her being very aware of what it took to kind of keep this life together.
Right. She had so many complex feelings about it. She was an elegant woman. Mm-hmm. She had a sense of style. She worked at Saks Fifth Avenue in the advertising department as a young woman after college, and she really liked to dress well.
Yeah.
And it was something to her to go out to the officers' club to a party on my father's arm when he's in his dress blues and she's in her black cocktail dresses and so forth. So that was fun, and she liked the elegant cosmopolitan life of moving around, living in Europe in these different places and getting to travel and see the world with him. But at the same time, it was very difficult for her to have to go through all of this moving, mm-hmm. never having mm-hmm. a home, never having a house that she could call her own. And then she also had certain attitudes about military life that she never really worked her way out of, you know. there was something in her. She grew up in a family that at one time had a great deal of money. And then it was very dramatically lost, all of it,
oh my.
In 1929. And her father left the family and left her and her siblings and her mother in pretty dire straits. But before that happened, she had been to boarding school. Her older sister had had a coming out party. Mm-hmm. Her mother had gone to Paris to buy her dresses and mm-hmm. things like that. So she had this very clear memory of being a person of a certain class.
Okay.
And when she married my father, they had met during the war, but then they married after the war. And then he was called back for the Korean War. And after he came back from Korea, he was thinking about staying out. But then, you know, he was invited to stay back in and to stay in, which he did. And Franny had a little bit of a hard time with that decision. I mean, she went along with it ultimately, but mm-hmm. she had an attitude that it was sort of, it wasn't the nice thing to do. You served the military as it was needed for your country, and then you got out.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But my dad didn't get out, and he liked flying airplanes, so she had to stay in with him.
Well, it's interesting. Your father's experience of World War II to Korea to Vietnam is almost mapping this huge shift in our attitudes towards what our warriors are and what our wars are and what being an American is and who's the enemy. And you were growing up, we're heading for 1968 in Paris and in your future there, kind of about to embody that change, sea change, a little bit ahead of them and outside
right.
the military. But it must have been really interesting. I just can't imagine what it was like for your father to I mean, do you think he was conscious of that shift in the military's the perception, the role played in the culture and our sense of who they are to us?
I think that he was aware of it as something that he really didn't like, clearly.
Uh-huh.
And he was very wary and suspicious, like a lot of military men of his time, of his generation, especially people working in Europe, military people working in Europe, who were just concerned that communists might be coming through any doorway, any crack, you know, and child could be susceptible to communist influence, to this kind of voice that he and his generation were terribly afraid of. You know, he didn't trust the Soviets at all. Nobody did in his generation. And when he saw the kinds of developments that were occurring in the United States, in all of the on all the campuses across the country, you know, he wanted very much to keep me away from that. But the irony is that where I got to go instead was to Paris.
Paris
which blew up in May of 68.
I'm so like, jealous.
Incidentally, you know, when we last heard of your book, it was entitled The Pilot's House. And now, of course, the name of it is The Fighter Pilot's Daughter. So I'm emphasizing the daughter as well, and would like to talk to you more about that when we come back. So there is, of course, the dilemmas of the Cold War and, of course, of this nation. And in family life has caused world tension and family tension. And that's what we'll discuss a little bit more as we journey on with Mary Lawler on Fighter Pilot's Daughter. We shall return to you momentarily after this salient message.
For program support on WDIY, we thank Touchstone Theater, presenting Christmas City Follies, Thursday, December 5th through the 22nd at Touchstone Theater. A Bethlehem holiday tradition, this Touchstone Theater Ensemble created classic yet again reimagines what the holidays are all about with music, wit, and holiday hijinks. For information, 610-867-1689 or touchstone.org.
This is Robert Siegel of All Things Considered. More news, less on-air fundraising is the goal at WDIY. Please make your contribution today and help WDIY make its goal and keep the pledge drive short. Help pay for the news and keep on-air fundraising interruptions to a minimum. Visit WDIY.org and give as generously as you can. Thanks.
We're back now with Mary Lawler, who's going to share a little bit of the intro from Fighter Pilot's Daughter with us. Mary, if you would.
Okay. The pilot's house where I grew up was mostly a women's world. There were five of us. We had the place to ourselves most of the time. My mother made the big decisions, where we went to school, which bank to keep our money in. She had to decide these things often because we moved every couple of years. The house is thus a figure of speech, a way of thinking about a long series of small cement dwellings we occupied as one fictional home. It was my father, however, who turned the wheel, his job that rotated us to so many different places. He was an aviator, first in the Marines, later in the Army. When he came home from his extended absences, missions they were called, the rooms shrank around him. There wasn't enough air. We didn't breathe as freely as we did when he was gone, not because he was mean or demanding, but because we worshipped him. Like satellites, my sisters and I orbited him at a distance, waiting for the chance to come closer, to show him things we'd made, accept gifts, hear his stories. My mother wasn't at the center of things anymore. She hovered, maneuvered, arranged, corrected. She was First Lady, the dame-in-waiting. He was the center point of our circle, a flyer, a winged sentry who spent most of his time far up over our heads. When he was home, the house was definitely his. These were the early years of the Cold War. It was a time of vivid fears, pictured nowadays in photos of kids hunkered under their school desks. My sisters and I did that. The phrase air raid drill rang hard. The double A sound, a cold metallic twang ending with ill. It meant rehearsal for a time when you might get burnt by the air you breathed. Every day we heard practice rounds of artillery fire and ordnance on the horizon. We knew what all this training was for. It was to keep the world from ending. Our father was one of many dads who sweat at soldierly labor, part of an arsenal kept at the ready to scare off nuclear annihilation of life on Earth. When we lived on post, my sisters and I saw uniformed men marching in straight lines everywhere. This was readiness, the soldiers rehearsing against Armageddon. The rectangular buildings where the commissary, the PX, the bowling alley, and the beauty shop were housed had fallout shelters in the basements, marked with black and yellow wheels, the civil defense insignia. Our dad would often leave home for several days on maneuvers, readiness exercises in which he and other men played war games designed to match the visions of big generals and political men, visions of how a Russian air and ground attack would happen. They had to be ready for it. A clipped nervous rhythm kept time on military bases. It was as if you needed to move efficiently to keep up with things, to be ready yourself, even if you were just a kid. We were chased by the feeling that life as we knew it could change in an hour.
Mm. Wow. What you just heard was Mary Lawler reading from her new book, and Fighter Pilot's Daughter. And there's this terrific sense of when I read the book, it brought me to points in my family life, even though my father was not a military man. There were some parallels that were very close about moving, not as much as you and your sister and your mom had to move, but certainly that sense of excitement that we're going to a new place, and then after a while a sense of, oh no, do we have to do that again? Has that affected you, Mary?
Yes. I mean, that's a very close description of what it felt like for us, too. There was a great deal of excitement in packing up and going to California or going to Germany, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. A new place with people who speak different languages or in the South speak English in different ways. Very exciting to discover these places and feeling that they were forms of adventure. But then at the same time, it meant that you had to leave behind the friends you had, mm-hmm. and you had to walk into a room full of kids who you didn't know. My parents often put us in Catholic schools instead of putting us in post schools. Hmm. And some of the bases where we were didn't have schools, so that we would have to go to public schools. So we would often find ourselves in these schools where we were complete strangers and there weren't even other military kids there.
Yes.
So, you know, we had to learn to stand up and go forward and introduce ourselves. And it was hard. It was really difficult.
Of course,
we never
yes.
got used to it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
We never did.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that stays with me now, a bit of that excitement about moving. And a certain learned ability to socialize, but always feeling like a stranger and always feeling like I don't quite belong anywhere.
It's interesting because I had the sense reading the book, something that struck me was I sometimes felt like you were watching your life, your family. As it came together as a narrative, that there was a sense of you discovering it by seeing it from far, like you were had stepped out of it and could see it, which also seemed to resonate with that sense of being the children always kind of the new kids, the kids doing the gauntlet on the first day of being inspected, of being seen, of being judged, of trying to fit in, of assessing and surviving. And
right, right,
That kind of observation all the time.
Right. We were being watched all the time. And it is interesting to have had to step back from all of that, and step back from my feelings about it in order to look at the memory and see it as a story and then to tell it as a narrative.
I think it's important for the listeners, since we won't have, you know, as nearly as much time as I'd like, also to know that in the arc of the book, as powerfully it evokes the Cold War period and growing up in that, there's also this wonderful energy and kind of forward motion of it as you are growing. Seriously, you end up in Paris in 68, and there's this intense confrontation with your father about where your life is heading, where your values and activities are going. And then the journey later beyond that of kind of finding your way back to your father, your mother's journey through all this. So there's a tremendous sense of motion, which is interesting given what we were just talking about,
right.
about what gypsies you had to kind of be. But there's also this tremendous forward movement through the book to me.
Well, good. I'm glad that comes across that way. It certainly felt like an arc to me as I was mapping it out. I mean, there were several drafts at first, and it took several drafts to get to a point where I could see just what that arc should be in the end. And it begins as me being a good and dutiful daughter for many years, and then finding my way sort of out of that in Paris as I meet people who, the kind of people I'd never met before, including draft resistors, you know, who had come to Paris to form a draft resistors union, but lots of leftists and anarchists and all the different sorts of people who joined in the demonstrations in May of 1968. I was reading all kinds of things that I had never come close to before. And so I emerged from this as something of a certainly a rebellious young woman, as something of a radical. I mean, there's a complicated story about my own participation in the Paris demonstrations, where in the thick of the, the chaos, I found myself locked in a cafe and thinking that I would perhaps be locked in there for a time. I stayed for a couple of hours. It turns out I probably could have left, but anyway, I chose to stay there and write instead of going out into the streets. So this kind of compromises my status as a radical to my mind. But in any case, it took several decades before I was able to find my way back to my father, who and who at that point was more ready to listen to me and talk to me. And my mother is there too. She doesn't go through the same transformations that he does, but she's always there as a presence for me, someone I had always identified with through the years, even though we two didn't get along. But by the end, I became much closer to both of them.
Well, I'm really thank you, Mary, very much. For your book is just a joy to read, and we want everyone else to read it too. And you can find Fighter Pilot's Daughter just about anywhere in a good bookstore.
It's actually online in a lot of the online stores.
All right.
Prices.
Very good. Very
and Mary also has, if you I Googled and went to the Muhlenberg page, you have a website as well. So you've got
Yes.
Very easy to.
Well, thank you very much for being here. Special thanks, too, to our confident and trustworthy pilot, Steve Aronson, who flies us through thick and thin in sleet and snow and 90-degree heat waves. Steve is our engineer with pizzazz and makes our voices blossom over the analog and digital airwaves. Thanks, Uncle Steve. And thank you again, Mary,
thank you.
For a wonderful book.
Thank you for having me here. It's been delightful.
Yes.